Hey everybody, and welcome to another edition of Forgotten Horror Classics. This is your old pal, the Moo Cow, also known as Paul A. Presenza. And I have with me today...
Lenore. Hi.
Hi, Miss Lenore. How are you?
Pretty good.
Outstanding. Well, tonight we will be watching a movie from 1981 called Dead and Buried. And this is a film that was directed by Gary Sherman... And the writers include Ronald Shusett and Dan O'Bannon from Alien fame, and stars Melody Anderson and James Ferrantino and Jack Albertson, amongst others. So this is kind of an interesting, offbeat, oddball kind of a horror film that came out in 1981. I remember seeing it in the theaters in high school. And it was just a weird film, and I think a lot of people just didn't really know what to make of it at the time. It was sort of a very odd film. It was a good film. I liked it, but I think for a number of reasons, it just didn't quite meet expectations at the time, and it's been kind of forgotten, especially by a lot of the younger crowd, so I wanted to bring this one out, screaming into the open light, as it were, so that other people can check it out. And, so why don't we listen to some spooky sounds, and then we will come back and discuss the movie. Okay, and we are back. Hello. So, Miss Lenore, what did you think of Dead and Buried?
It was a creepy movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm annoyed that nobody was brought to justice at the end. If anything, he got away with it even more than he was hoping to.
True, true, true. All right, well, let's get a little background on this film. So, as I said, this movie was put out in 1981. And it was directed by a guy named Gary A. Sherman. And this was originally based on a story by Jeff Miller and Alex Stern. They're the ones who originally came up with this movie idea. And originally this was supposed to have been a black comedy. Alex Stern did not have any prior experience. And Jeff Miller apparently wrote sort of an after-school special back in 1976. But that was really about it. So these guys were newbies, and they had been shopping it around, and apparently Ronald Shusett, who was also the producer, somebody who had worked with Dan O'Bannon before, they worked together to put out the movie Alien. You've seen the movie Alien, right? The original movie?
I think so.
Okay, well, it's a really good film. And Dan O'Bannon, of course, is also known for things like Return of the Living Dead and Total Recall and just a whole slew of science fiction-based films. He's quite well-known. So they decided to do this film, and then they brought it to Gary Sherman. So Gary Sherman is an interesting guy. He has done a lot of films in America and England and Canada. His first film that he did was called Death Line, which was released in the United States as Raw Meat in 1972. I've actually not seen that film, but it's supposed to be pretty good, and I believe it's considered one of the best British films of the 70s. So at some point, I'd like to check that out. And then he also did a movie called Vice Squad with Wings Hauser back in 1982, a movie that I always thought was kind of a good film. It was sort of a guilty pleasure. I can't say it's a really great film, but it's a very dark street-related kind of film, and I always kind of liked it. And in high school, it was like a big thing. And then Gary Sherman did Poltergeist 3, the infamous third Poltergeist film in 1988. And the reason that's infamous is because during that production, that's when the little girl, Heather O'Rourke, died. And originally, they wanted to stop the production of the film. And the people who backed the film decided to go with sort of a double and use earlier footage to sort of simulate Heather O'Rourke being there, which is kind of creepy and weird. So he was the director in that, and he also did another interesting, odd, and quirky movie called Lisa in 1990 with Cheryl Ladd. Amongst the TV films and TV series that he was involved in, he was in a film, did a TV film called The Streets in 1984. And for TV, he is the creator of Missing Persons back in 1993. He also did Poltergeist, The Legacy in 1997. And he also did a number of episodes for the first 48 Missing Persons. I don't know if you've ever saw that. It's a good series. And so he's done a lot of stuff. He did a lot of horror earlier, but as time has gone on, he's sort of turned to other things. I know some of the last things he's working on, he's done a couple of documentaries and a couple of shorts for other things. And there are fans, including the Spanish director Guillermo del Toro, who would like to see him return to horror. And so it would be nice. And this edition that we watched actually is the limited edition double DVD by Blue Underground, and there's all kinds of great commentary, including commentary from the director himself. Had a lot of interesting notes and a lot of interesting information about the film and the making of the film. So that is the director of Dead and Buried. The stars, Melody Anderson, who's someone that I've always loved, she's the actress who plays Janet Gillis. I think I mentioned before, in the 80s, she was kind of like one of my favorite actresses, so seeing her in this film was kind of a big deal for me. So she started off in Welcome Back, Kotter, a lot of TV series, the original Battlestar Galactica, Dallas, T.J. Hooker, The A-Team, Chips, Murder, She Wrote. And as far as movies, she's most popular or most remembered by playing the role of Dale Arden in the 1980 Flash Gordon. She was also in a movie with Nicolas Cage called The Boy in Blue in 1986. And also that same year, she was in a movie called Firewalker with Chuck Norris and Louis Gossett Jr. It's kind of a crappy film. And after the early 90s, she retired as an actress and ended up becoming a professional social worker. And I believe she actually has practices in Manhattan and Los Angeles. So she's actually done very well for herself, although I think she does on occasion still go to horror conventions because people do, like me, still remember her and are still fans of her work. So the other main star is James Ferrantino. He's the guy who plays Sheriff Dan Gillis. He's been in a ton of movies. And the most famous one that I remember him being is a favorite of mine, another forgotten film that it's more of a historical drama than it is a horror film. It's called The Warlord with Charlton Heston. That's one of my favorite films, and he was in that. He was in 1965. He was in a movie called Ride to Hangman's Tree in 1967. He was in The Longest Night in 1972. He was in the TV production of Jesus of Nazareth in 1977, and in fact was nominated for an Emmy Award for his performance. He was in The Final Countdown. He was in a movie called License to Kill in 1984, and a movie called Bulletproof in 1996 with Damon Wayans and Adam Sandler. And he was on a bunch of TV shows as well, including Dynasty. He was on the Blue Thunder TV show with Roy Scheider. And he has kind of a complicated history. Apparently, he had a number of run-ins with the law, the most famous of which is because he was involved with Tina Sinatra, who was Frank Sinatra's youngest daughter. Apparently, he and she did not get along, and he was eventually charged with stalking her, and there was some, you know, bad stuff associated with that. He eventually died in 2012 at the age of 73, but he's a very distinctive actor, and I always kind of liked him. And then the third big actor in this film is Jack Albertson, who plays Dobbs, the creepy mortuary guy. And of course, anybody who's watched movies for a long time instantly recognizes him. He was the old man Charlie's father in Willy Wonka, the original Willy Wonka movie back in 1971. He was also in The Poseidon Adventure in 1972. He was in a whole bunch of TV shows, The Twilight Zone, Andy Griffith Show, The Virginian, and he was actually in the entire run for a film called, or a TV series called Chico and the Man, and he actually won an Emmy Award for that. And he actually died in 1981 during the make, or just after the making of this film. Dead and Buried was his last film, and the poor man had cancer.
Aww.
And he was very sick throughout the entire production.
Oh.
So I think one of the reasons why his performance is so good and so creepy is I think he knew he was coming to the end. And I think he really wanted to go out with a bang, and he really wanted to put on the best possible performance, because this is a character or kind of character that he had never done before. He had never done a villain or anybody creepy like this. He had always been kind of like the kindly older guy who has common sense that when nobody else does, as opposed to this sort of creepy older guy.
Also, if he's dying and he's playing a character obsessed with death and perfection in death and all that.
Sure, absolutely. So he
adds a kind of
subtext
there.
He brings a very, very interesting perspective to his role. So, you know, I don't know whether the casting directors knew that ahead of time or not, but he puts on a great performance. And matter of fact, everybody does a great performance. And you're right, he does to a creepy performance. It's pretty amazing. There are a number of other famous sort of supporting actors in this. Robert Englund, who is, of course, Freddy Krueger, is one of the guys. This is one of his early roles. You will also see Christopher Allport there as one of the victims. He is in the Jack Frost series, which, of course, Indie Film Cafe covered. So I thought Jonathan Moody would find that interesting. Also, Michael Pataki, who is a character actor from the 50s, 60s, 70s, and into the 80s, and even beyond. He was in a million different films, a lot of stinky, crappy horror films as well, including Dracula's Dog, The Return of Count Yorga, Get Christy Love, and just a whole bunch of stuff. So he was in there. Lisa Blount, who plays the poor hitchhiker, she was in a bunch of things. She was in Prince of Darkness and Night Flyers in 1987. She was an Officer and a Gentleman in 1982, and a movie called Femme Fatale in 1991. And I found it an interesting and fun little tidbit about Lisa Blount. Apparently, her very first appearance on TV is on The Gong Show back in 1977, and she appears on the exact same episode as Pee Wee Herman. So there you go. It's funny how some of these actors sort of start off. So there's a lot of professional muscle behind this film. As I said, this is Dan O'Bannon and Ronald Shusett, who were responsible for Aliens, among other great science fiction. So after Alien became a big hit, they sort of had, I don't want to say carte blanche, but they had sort of the ability to kind of go out and make more films. And this is one that they had apparently been working on for quite some time, trying to get its life. And after Alien and the wonderful movie that they made and the money that it made, they were able to get this production off the ground, more or less. More about that in a few minutes. I also would like to remind everyone that the special effects, which are also one of the big stars in this film, is by Stan Winston, who has been in a ton of different films and is extremely famous for his special effects. And there were some pretty gory, cringeworthy, horrific special effects. I saw you hiding a couple of times.
Yeah.
There are two scenes in particular. There's the one with the needle in the eye. I could tell you didn't particularly love that scene.
No, I hid.
Did you? I was about to say, did you actually see it? You hid.
Yes, I hid.
And then there is the time-lapse photography of the corpse of the dead hitchhiker, which actually was pretty cool. I think you saw that one, didn't you?
The dead hitchhiker.
Right, where he's disassembling her face and down to the bone and then reassembling it.
Oh, yeah.
And was using, do you remember what the name of the technique is for all of that he was doing? When he was reapplying her face to make her more beautiful?
I don't know. It looked like he was sculpting.
It did look like he was sculpting. Well, it was photographed in a sort of time-lapse photography so that you're seeing pieces go on. Piece here, piece there, layer here, layer there, until the face comes back. And it was a pretty impressive bit of special effects there. And Stan Winston is known for that sort of thing. So what else about this film? This film was made on a budget of $3 million, which is not too bad for the time. I was unable to find out what the box office was, but I remember when this came out, and a lot of people really didn't quite know what to do with this film. It feels more like a Twilight Zone episode than it does a standard horror film.
It does. It really does.
Or even more like a nightmare. You really can't tell what's going to happen next because it doesn't obey the standard laws of most horror film narratives. And because of that, that makes it even more creepy because you really don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, it's like the climax of the plot seems like it's all the way at the end, and then it ends.
Right, right. But it's a pretty fascinating film. And as I said, I don't think audiences quite knew what they were seeing at the time. And it wouldn't surprise me if the movie either had a loss or it just didn't. It didn't really make most of its money back, which is unfortunate because it's a really, really good film. And it's pretty well forgotten other than really, really, really diehard horror fans. And it's one that I've always liked and always wanted to have a copy of. So let's talk for a few minutes about the plot. So go ahead. Miss Lenore, you're very good at encapsulating plots.
Okay. So this whole movie starts with a photographer on arriving at a beach and meeting a local woman who he photographs. And then the rest of the town shows up, they take photos of him, and then they beat him with shovels and crowbars, and then they wrap him in a net and light him on fire.
Weren't expecting that, were you?
No, I was not. But they take photographs and they take film of him while doing this. And the whole town is taking part. And then they light his car on fire and stuff him in there.
To try to make it look like it's an accident.
Yeah. And from that point forward, it basically follows the sheriff trying to work out what is going on. While all these other people are dying in fairly similar ways. One person's car gets... Well, they hit a pole. They were stalked through a house. They managed to escape. And then later on, their car was found in the ocean.
Oh, this is the family with the little kid.
Yes. Oh, yeah, the little kid dies.
And then there's a drunk sailor. Talk about him, because you squealed a lot in that one, too.
Okay, so there's also a sailor who is drunk and talking to himself on a boat. And then suddenly, people just appear out of nowhere. Like, their hands are breaking through the walls behind him, and they have, like, giant hooks, and they slice across his face and grab him and pull, and it's cutting into him, and eh.
And eh.
And, yeah, he dies, too.
Pretty violent.
Yeah. But then all these people start showing back up in town perfectly healthy and perfectly fine. And while all of this is going on, at first it seems like his wife is cheating on him, and he's stressed out about that.
This is the sheriff.
Yes, the sheriff. The movie follows the sheriff. And he's trying to figure out what's going on. He's getting missing persons being sent in from other parts of town where these people are coming from. He's finding these people who he knows are dead in town, wandering around, and looking perfectly fine with no idea what's happened. His wife might or might not be cheating on him. He has no real way of knowing. But she's also teaching a class, she's teaching them film, and also lecturing them on witchcraft to keep them from getting bored.
As you do.
Yeah. So, all of that is going on, and it just gets a creepier and creepier atmosphere all throughout the movie because of it. And then he finally goes and he digs up one of the graves of the person of the photographer from the beginning who was killed. Because he got a missing persons report from them, and he saw someone who looked just like them in town. So he digs it up, he opens it, and there's no body inside the grave.
But what is there inside the grave?
There is, however, his heart wrapped up in his shirt. Just tossed into the box.
And that's significant because earlier...
The witchcraft book said that in order to bring somebody back to life and control them, you have to take out their heart and bury it or hide it somewhere.
Right. So somebody has been doing this.
Yeah. And as it goes on, he suspects all kinds of different people. He thinks it's his wife at one point, but it's not. He thinks it's the mortician's apprentice, but it's not. And it just goes through this, and it gets creepier because people are kind of blocking his investigation. Oh, also, he briefly runs over somebody.
Right. He hits the one guy, and then he ends up getting the sample, the skin sample, off of the hood. And it's funny because...
The arm is still moving.
Right. He hits the guy. The guy's on the ground.
His arm is not. It's on the grill.
The arm is on the grill, and he feels it. He turns around, and it's like clutching and grabbing.
It's not connected to the guy.
Also. Not at all.
So he freaks out.
As you would.
Later on, he collects a sample from the grill and sends it off to be tested. And he says, these samples have been dead at least a few months. Are you sure this happened recently? So he freaks out, and then that guy dies too. And then it gets way to the end, where he finally develops the film that his wife's students had been making. And it's creepy. Basically, somebody's walking through town, and they stop at a window and see two people having sex. And then suddenly, stabbing happens, and everybody shows up with cameras, and more stabbing happens.
And what is the big reveal of the scene?
He runs to the morticians, and the mortician just clicks a light or a switch or something, and suddenly tons of films just pop up all over the hall, and all of them are of somebody getting brutally murdered. And there's one for every person in town.
Including?
Then his wife shows up and is begging to be buried because I guess she's just found out that she's dead.
Well, that was the big reveal when he saw the film.
Yeah, the big reveal that his wife is dead.
Is that his wife was the one killing somebody. Mm-hmm. And that's why he runs over, because he also got the information from the telex saying that Dobbs had been disbarred and run out of town. Out of Rhode Island because he had been doing unauthorized things with dead bodies. So he had actually been there since 1970 having his fun. And he goes there to confront him, and that's when he's showing him all the pictures. And then his wife shows up and he demonstrates that he can control her and that she doesn't even seem to know that she's dead. And the sheriff is all freaked out and starts shooting her. And at first, she's just like talking. You know, she's like trying to tell him what to have for dinner until she finally says, I'm dead. Please bury me. And then she runs off.
So he follows and ends up burying her. And then all of the town shows up.
I mean, the entire town.
Yes, everybody in town shows up with flowers. And they lay them on the grave while staring at him. They say things like, may she rest in peace, and then they suddenly take out cameras and start clicking them at him and try to grab him and kill him, and then he runs off back to the mortician's office, where it turns out the mortician
has one more piece of interesting film to show him.
Well, the mortician died and brought himself back to life by stabbing himself in the stomach with large, pointy electrodes.
As you do.
Yeah. But then he runs back in, and the guy's perfectly fine again, because he's turned himself into a puppet. And then he finally has one last thing to show him, which is that he is dead. The sheriff is dead. He was one of the earlier victims. He was the person his wife had murdered in that movie.
And it's such a creepy reveal, too, because the guy starts looking at his fingers, and the fingers are all starting to fall apart.
Yeah, and then the last line is, come here, let me fix those for you, because he's a mortician. His job is to make dead people look not dead.
So, there you go. That's the plot in a nutshell, and... You know, it's even more complicated than it sounds, but it's very, very creepy. It's very well paced. A lot happens, and the way that it's done is just scary throughout. I saw you hiding multiple times.
Oh, yeah, they have this warning music that it's like foghorns mixed with piano. It is creepy. It is really creepy. I was basically reflexively hiding anytime I heard it.
Yeah, I saw you hiding during the scene where the couple with the car that run into the pole and they go into the abandoned house. Yeah, you were creeped out the whole time, I could tell.
I could see the shadows moving from the people.
Right.
It's like, but the right How do you not see them? They're right there. Why aren't you leaving?
Well, it's interesting because it's one of those techniques where the audience gets to see the monster or the creature or the whatever is creating the horror while the characters don't. So there's where the tension is, because you're doing exactly what you're doing. You're like, why aren't you? You go, move. You know, you're kind of, you're trying to make the people, you're trying to help the people by informing them that they need to go because there's something horrible there and something bad's about to happen. And you can't because they're sort of locked into it. It's like their fate.
Oh, yeah, that reminds me. One more thing. That one scene where he's looking for dogs, the sheriff is, and he runs through the office and closes the door behind him. And as it closes, one of the morgue chilled drawer things opens up. And after it closes, the door closes and this opens, the bench with the body on it rolls out on its own. And then suddenly it sits up and the sheet falls and it's Dobbs, perfectly fine. He sleeps in the morgue.
As you do. I'm sure it's quiet and comfy and cool.
Aren't those really cold?
Yeah, I guess so. There's a number of creepy things that happen throughout the film. One of my favorites and one of the creepiest parts, in my opinion, is we've already seen the original guy, the photographer, getting murdered.
Yeah.
In a not very pleasant way at all.
Twice.
Then we see him in the car, where the car's been on fire, and they bring the mortuary guy over with the cop, and you don't really suspect it at the moment, and he's telling him, so what do you think the cause of death is? And he lays down to take a look, and you see the burned, horrific remains of the guy, and it starts to scream! He's not dead!
Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah. He's not dead. He was lit on fire.
Ugh.
Twice, if you count being stuffed into the burning car. And then he's still alive, and he goes to the hospital, and he's in pretty bad shape. He's basically all bandages, except for part of his mouth and one of his eyes.
Right, he's got, like, third-degree burns over, like, 90% of his body. It's really, really bad.
And then we hear the doctor say, I mean, you can talk to him, but you won't understand very much because he doesn't have lips anymore, which is creepy. And then the nurse, you can see the nurse walking in the background.
And who is the nurse?
The person who lured the photographer to.
In the very first scene.
Yeah.
The blonde chick.
It's really interestingly shot because she's in the middle of the hallway, way in the background. But the lights are reflecting off the floor in a straight line, and she's following that straight line. And the two people, the doctor and the sheriff, are on either side in the foreground. And then she's walking up. And then she turns suddenly into the room they just left with the burned guy.
And it's brilliant because, for all we know, it's just a nurse. And yet, we see her enter the room, and all of a sudden, I don't know if you felt it, but I felt a little unease. It's like, you knew something wasn't right.
Yeah. And then it goes into the room, and she's looking at the guy, and you can see his one eye. And he's completely immobilized. He can't move at all. But his eye is uncovered and open. And then you can see the needle. And then the eye. And then the needle. And this is when I hid.
Yeah. That's because, you know, she's basically torturing the guy. The poor guy is quivering in his bandages. And he can't talk. He can't scream. He can't do anything. He certainly can't protect himself. And she's like, oh, I'm going to give you something that's going to make you feel so much better. And she pulls out this, like, eight-inch needle. And while you hid, she stabs him right in the eye, which was a horrible thing. Now, I did a little research on that, and that is a Stan Winston classic. It's a dummy with a dummy eye, but it's shot in such a way that it really, really looks real. So, yeah, it's a very creepy, very awful, horrible scene. And then it pulls back and you get to see him laying there with the darn needle in his eye. So it's gone from having a accident victim and a murder with the sailor to now being two murders because somebody went to the trouble of murdering this poor defenseless burn victim and nobody knows why.
Yeah, it's a very creepy movie.
And then bodies start disappearing because people are getting stolen from there and
from the morgue and from their graves.
Right, right, right. And before, when you think you might know who it is, like, the, you know, you see him working on the hitchhiker girl and you see like the instruments pulling the empty eye socket and putting in a false eye. And then a minute later, she stands up. It's like it hasn't changed. I know that that's a camera trick, but it looks realistic. It looks like she literally just got up after that. And somebody in the background, remember, comes over and like kind of touches her and then backs off and seemed like it had a woman's coat on.
Yeah.
And you think, well, it's not the creepy mortician that we've been assuming who's been behind this all along. Who the heck was that? And why did they do that? And it's already creepy. I mean, he's already got his creepy bona fides established. I mean, he's sleeping in refrigerated vaults meant for dead bodies. He's talking about how his art is about, you know, making the dead look even more beautiful than they were alive, and how it's a shame to waste them by burying them. And he wants to contact the families and let him do his magic on them, quote unquote. But then, even when he's bringing forth and changing the dead hitchhiker, he starts kissing her.
Yeah.
It's so creepy and awful.
Yeah, like partway around that time in the movie, I thought the twist was going to be that there were two Dobbs. Like, one of them was real and another was a copy. Or a twin brother that was killed and brought back or something. Nope, that was not the case.
Or, you know, I thought for a little bit, perhaps Dobbs was one of the dead people already and being controlled by somebody else.
And I thought it was the blonde woman at the beginning.
Right, either that or someone we just weren't introduced to yet.
Yeah, because how would anybody... Because she's the one who calls the photographer Freddy at the beginning and says, "You look like a Freddy. I'm going to call you Freddy." And then when he comes back to life and he's working in the town, his name is Freddy.
Right, so not only do we know that she knows that she's going to kill them, she already knows that he's going to come back. And when he comes back, he's going to have a new identity. And she's already decided it's going to be Freddy. So that's like creepy on like 10 different levels there.
Yeah, except it turns out she's not the one doing any of this.
Nope, but she's certainly having fun and enjoying herself. You do get that one little flash of boobage there. That was like the only nudity. In fact, it was so quick I had forgotten about it. But she was clearly getting into her role as being the femme fatale, the dead femme fatale, luring this poor photographer. And of course, they make it even more hard on the sheriff because they went into his room and removed everything that had any kind of identification. So they couldn't figure it out. Now, the game within the game here, of course, is that everybody turns out dead. So my only real question about the film is, why does The Undertaker go through so much pains? Is he enjoying himself? Is he like winding up his toys and letting them play out? If the sheriff is also dead, then he can pretty much control him. He doesn't have to go through all of this stuff.
I think that's the best explanation, is he's playing.
Right. So these are his toys, and he's created them, and now he's wound them up and let them go off to do their thing. So, yeah, it's definitely a very creepy, strange movie. The direction is really, really good. The cinematography is fabulous. They talked about how the beach scene, which is the very first thing with the photographer and then the femme fatale, was actually one of the last scenes that they shot. And because the rest of the film is very, very misty and gloomy and overcast, the weather was changing and it was getting nicer and brighter in California. The whole thing is supposed to be set in Maine, so they found this California town that was very gloomy and misty and foggy, and it looked great. But towards the end of the film, it was getting bright and sunny, but they still had this last scene to shoot, so they had to jury-rig a couple of cranes with some canvas and some silks to sort of not only block out the light, but to reflect and diffuse a lot of the light that was coming through in order to sort of change the light balance, because, you know, this is all before digital cameras and before you could do all that stuff later on. This is all stuff you have to do on the fly. And it's really an amazing effect, because, you know, at the same time you're seeing the beach and you're seeing all the things on the beach through the man's camera. So it's got this sort of fuzzy, gauzy look to it. Did you notice that?
Mm-hmm.
And you're seeing everything with a little viewfinder in the middle, and it's just sort of an extra layer of coolness, in my opinion. And the scene is still looks very foggy and very gauzy, and it turns out it's because they did all that refraction and all of that diffusion of light, and it wasn't just because they had fog. So they know what they were doing when they were making this film, and they definitely put out all stops in order to make it as creepy and as realistic as possible. So I appreciate that. What did you think about the acting performances from everyone?
Well done. Really well done. Also, I just realized something. When Dobbs says that the wife visits him a lot, he remember later on he says that he has to give the people touch-ups now and then so they still look human.
Right.
He said the wife didn't need them as frequently as the others, but like once a month or every few weeks or so.
Yeah, he says that while the others were drawings, she was his masterpiece. She was the painting.
Which is weird, because didn't he say she was one of the first?
Right.
I think he'd improve with time, not worsen with time.
Well, either that or because he put most of his efforts into the first one or something. I don't know. I'm not 100% sure about that. Or maybe it's just because he found her more beautiful than the others. She was originally dead in a creek, and he was talking about her bloated corpse. Certainly doesn't look like it now. Now, I guess that's probably the reason why when the sheriff finds out that she's dead, then you're thinking to yourself, how could you not know that you're sleeping with a dead body this entire time? Well, that's because he was dead too, so it didn't feel any different. So basically, the mortuary guy has the whole town is his playpen. And every stranger that comes in, he's having them murdered. He's having them photographed because A, shits and giggles, and B, he has a picture of what they look like before they're killed. And then he gets to do his quote-unquote magic on them, and then he cuts out their heart and buries it and resurrects their ass, gives them a new identity, and populates the town so that the entire town is basically a zombie town, and they don't even know it. Crazy.
Well, at the end, when they were talking about the Janet, the sheriff's wife, it seemed like they knew.
Well, some of them knew, maybe not all of them.
But they were talking about how Janet should be envied and all that.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like they knew. And they were all visibly...
Well,
their skin was messed up.
I don't think Freddie knew. And I don't think some of the other ones knew. I think it all kind of depended. It seemed like what Dobbs was saying was that he could give them memories and he could give them things. And I guess he doesn't necessarily give the same thing or the same level to all of them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But, yeah, more creep factors. Remember the family that gets killed that initially runs into the telephone pole and you think they might have gotten away, and then they find the car in the ocean. The kid ends up in the classroom being taught the voodoo stuff.
Oh, yeah. Which is creepy because my college, for history class, I think or French or something related to that, it was either French or Haitian history they were covering that day. They gave us a lecture on the voodoo religion.
Really? So people actually do this in school?
I mean, this was college, not high school, but yeah.
Well, it wasn't even a god. It was grade school, I think, for these guys.
Yeah. But they're going over what the various gods were, because it's actually a religion. It's not creepy spells bringing people back to life. It's an actual, fully fleshed out religion.
Which, actually, there is a movie called Serpent in the Rainbow. I don't know if you've ever seen it. But it postulates, and it's based on a book, and it postulates that the thing bringing back the dead as zombies was actually a drug.
Oh, yeah. What drug was it? Because I remember reading about that as a kid.
Yeah, bufotoxin from a specific toad or specific fish, and that they're able to make the poison that way, the zombie poison, and then that's how they're able to resurrect them. Or
I thought it was a mix of a few of them. There's
it's probably
this one poison that can make you appear dead for 3 days.
Right.
And it can fool most doctors. I think that's from pufferfish.
And I think that's what it was saying in the film, is that the folks are not actually really dead, but they think they're dead. They go into an almost dead state, and then they get buried because the doctors all think that they're dead. And it's a very traumatic experience, and you have to claw your way out of the ground. And, you know, if all you've been brought up is in a religion of where voodoo and zombies exist, of course you're going to think that you're a zombie too.
And also there's like this drug you can give them afterwards that kind of removes their willpower. I don't know if it actually does or if they just think it does, because of that religion thing. But they already think they're dead. They think that somebody has brought them back to life to be their servant. And somebody can easily take advantage of that, feed them some plants or whatever, and say it's that thing
right.
that does that in their religion.
Well, and it's,
they have a servant who's convinced they're dead.
It's interesting because in the film, you know, he asks him, the sheriff asks Dobbs, how did you do it? And he replies something to the tune of, you can call it black magic, you can call it science, whatever it is, it's my secret and I'm taking it to the grave. So he sidesteps the whole thing. And that's a good thing because, you know, a lot of movies will trip over themselves trying to explain something and then they'll end up sounding silly or it'll end up sounding, you know, far-fetched and ridiculous and whatever.
Because it quickly gets dated.
Exactly. So in this way, he just simply sidesteps it and, you know, don't worry about it. And really, the audience doesn't need to know because we're already caught up in the whole scare horror aspect of it. We don't need to know the science part of it, although perhaps somebody like yourself or your sister might find it interesting.
My sister studies forensic science.
So the whole concept of reanimation of dead tissue, I'm sure, is an interesting topic she'd love to talk about. I don't know if you have any interest or any background in any of that.
I don't.
But I do remember one of the doctors, though, one of the poor scientists that ends up getting acid through his nostrils. He asked him, the sheriff asks him, in your professional opinion, can this sort of thing happen? And of course, he's asking him after he's already been resurrected, so he's like, oh, yeah, it's ridiculous, ridiculous.
Oh, yeah, I was going to comment on that. The people who made this movie have no idea what acid burns look like.
Probably not.
Because it looked like he was growing horns. Acid burns don't do that.
Yeah, there were. What happened was is that in the early 80s, Stan Winston and some other special effects guys had this way of sort of pumping out air. I think it was air. But it's basically inflating different parts in order to sort of make it look like new flesh was coming. Do you remember one of the very first movies I showed you was American Werewolf in London?
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember when he was turning from a human into a werewolf and all of the things were popping out? Mm-hmm. That's exactly that kind of special effect.
Cool.
Just, it was on a smaller scale because they just wanted to show, you know, the skin, I guess, puffing up and I guess the acid having that effect on there. But you deal with acids all the time.
So I've never had acid burns, but I've had classmates who did have acid burns. They don't look like that at all.
So what do they look like?
So in my friend's case, it was pretty mild. He spilled it on his hand, and it didn't actually blister. The skin just wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
No blistering or anything.
So it's just flesh?
Yeah, pretty much, except with a bad acid burn, it doesn't really look like a burn. It's not there.
Huh.
There's no blistering or anything. And then when it heals back very pale. There's no melanin or anything. It stays that way. That's like a characteristic of chemical burns.
So it never comes back, the melanin?
No.
Oh, interesting.
Well, the permanent burns. My friend's healed fully, thankfully.
I remember we kind of discussed this a little bit when we did the previous film, The Witch's Mirror. Remember we talked about the... No, I'm sorry. It wasn't The Witch's Mirror. It was the... it was the... wrestling, it was the Aztec mummy movie.
Yeah.
Because remember the guy had acid in his face and you said, acid burns would not do that kind of scarring on the guy's face. Remember he kept hiding?
Mm-hmm.
That was Bruno. Yeah. So we kind of had that discussion about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, different types of acid can have different types of effects. And also you can be burned by strong bases as well, not just strong acids.
Yeah, I've heard about that. Things like, that's why you're never supposed to for a number of reasons, you're not supposed to drink bleach or borax or anything like that because it'll just melt your internal organs and...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Pretty horrific stuff. But basically the point is what you're saying is the blistering effect would not have really happened.
No, different types of acids can leave different types of burns, but... Even the worst ones, they don't really leave blisters, they just kind of leave brown sludge.
And they will heal eventually. It's just,
yeah.
In this case, they stuck them up the poor guy's nose and into his sinus cavities.
So there is one thing I can think of that might have had that effect.
Okay.
It's a chemical called bromide.
Bromide. Everybody's best friend.
This stuff is horrible.
Really? Why?
Okay, so if you burn yourself with it, it's not going to heal. It will blister badly, and then the blisters will pop and peel off. And then it'll look like it's healing, but then 2 weeks later, they'll do that again.
Ugh.
And it can take up to a year for it to heal, to even start healing. And this cycle will just keep continuing until that time is up.
Wow.
Now, here's the thing. My professor's professor in college broke one of the cardinal rules of lab safety and brought a can of Coke into the lab with him.
Uh-oh.
And set it up onto the shelf next to a beaker of bromide. And he wasn't thinking, and he reached up and grabbed the Coke, what he thought was the Coke, and drank it. And he'd already swallowed it before he realized that it was not Coke, it was bromide.
Ugh.
He died. He died very horribly. I'm not going to say anything else. Just, he died.
Ugh.
Yeah.
So, not a good way to go. Well, let me ask you this. What would bromide be doing in the lab like the doctor in that movie might have had?
Hard to say. I don't know what kind of work he did. It looked like he did forensic work.
Okay, so you think there are possible applications for bromide in forensic work?
That's probably a better question for my sister, but, bromine probably does, well, probably.
Hmm. Curious. Well, at least we know some of the science parts are done mostly correctly. She would have been a good person to show on this the whole time, because she loves her forensics and... Yeah, I think she probably would have liked this film.
Or she would have been hiding, too. Hard to say. In many ways, my sister has a tougher stomach than I do.
There you go. But as far as the rest of the production went, everything seemed really good. The lighting was fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
We already talked about that one scene in the hallway in the hospital. That was really, really well done. When they were going into when he was looking for the guy that he thought he ran over, or he did run over, and... I guess it turned out to be like some kind of extended chicken coop because the chicken jumps out and he shoots at it. The lighting in that was really, really good because you could just barely see something, but you couldn't tell what it was, and it was just scary enough. And, every time they brought in the big lights to take the pictures with, you know, that added more light and it looked really good. The settings were all great. Remember that big, giant Victorian house that they were set up in?
Yeah, that was a pretty house.
It was a really cool house. Everything with the as far as the settings go, I mean, everything looked believable. Everything looked really, really good. Everybody did a good performance. There was no bad acting in any of it. It wasn't even crappy acting. Everything was really good. The music I thought was fabulous. Not just the foghorny kind of music, but the music, the sort of background that builds up suspense was really excellent. And there's this really haunting piano piece that goes on at the beginning and the end of the film that I thought was great. And it doesn't overwhelm it. It doesn't become too much, which is really good. Just everything was spot on. So this is definitely, definitely a movie that I would recommend to other people and I would recommend to sort of dig up. As I've said, Blue Underground has this out in double DVD. I have no idea if this is out in Blu-ray yet. It would not surprise me if it does come out in Blu-ray. It should. But this is definitely a film that I think needs to re-find its audience because when it first came out, it was very, very, it was confusing, I think, to most people, and they didn't quite know if it was a zombie movie, if it was a slasher movie, if it was a, you know, some other kind of film, because it sort of blended a number of things. And the reason, and I think I mentioned this earlier, that this happened is because the original screenplay, the original story that this was based on was a black comedy. And when Dan O'Bannon and Ronald Shusett got a hold of it, they liked it as a black comedy, and then they wrote a screenplay for the movie and kept the black comedy elements of it. And that's how the movie started off. But in the commentary, the director, Gary Sherman, talks about how the people who backed it, the financing, fell through several times. So There was a group that financed it in the pre-production. There was a group who financed it as the movie was being made. And then there was a totally different group that financed it in the post-production. And the group that was in the post-production decided that they did not like the comedic elements of it. They didn't want it to be a black comedy. They wanted it to be a straight-up horror film.
To be honest, I'd say it works pretty well as horror.
Exactly. And
I'm kind of struggling to find a way to make this concept funny.
Exactly. Kind of jumped the gun a little bit. But yeah, they wanted this to be more of a gore-oriented, scare-oriented horror film. And they did some reshoots. They added in some more, you know, violence and some more stuff. And it turns out Dan O'Bannon actually disowned the film.
Oh, why did he do that?
He didn't like the way that it turned out because it lost all of the black comedic elements of it. So he has talked about how he just didn't really want to be associated. And it's kind of a shame because I thought they did a really, really good job, even though it's kind of scrambled and because of the different financiers that came in and did some extra cutting and extra editing and extra moving things around. You know, you could tell that it's been altered, but it's not to the point where the film suffers.
Yeah, it's a really well done film. It's sad that he disowned it.
Yeah, and you never know. I mean, he may come around to it, or you never know. At some point, I don't know who owns the rights to this film, but every now and again, the people will who own the rights or people will get the rights back to their films, and they'll re-release them as director's cuts. And if this is ever released in a director's cut, or if this is ever put out on a Blu-ray, you might find, you know, deleted scenes, or you might find other versions of the film that maybe have the black comedy elements incorporated back in there. Now, I think that that's going to tell a very different story. I think you could kind of make a black comedy out of it, but I'm not necessarily sure you would make that a better film, in my opinion. I think it works perfectly fine the way it is. Maybe in 1981 it was a little different. They were doing some weird stuff in the early 80s just to sort of change things up. You know, I think the very next year some of these people also were the ones who got involved with Halloween 3 Season of the Witch, which is, you know, Halloween in name only. It's only because this very, very different take on the Halloween thing, which I believe is also a Dan O'Bannon was involved in that. And you know, instead of being Michael Myers, like in the first two Halloween movies, it's all about this nut job who is going to make bugs come out of kids' masks at Halloween for some stupid reason. It's a ridiculous movie. But they sort of went at it in a very different way. And I think that's characteristic of this film, is that they sort of went at the zombie thing, and they went at the voodoo thing, and they went at the slasher thing in a very different way and sort of combined all those elements in a way that hadn't really been done before and ended up confusing a heck out of a lot of people. There are a lot of critics who like the film. They're not 100% sure why, but I don't know that this movie's ever really found its audience other than for people like myself who like oddball sorts of things. But what about you? Did you? I know that it affected you as far as you hiding, but you said it was creepy, but did you like it?
Yes. It was well made. It was well done. It's going to give me nightmares. But it was well done. I liked it. I was creeped out by it, but I liked it.
So it pretty much accomplishes what it set out to do then.
Yeah.
Okay. So would you say it was as creepy and scary as Woman in Black? Because I think that's the one that was haunting you.
No, Woman in Black is creepier just because of that one scene with the lady on the ceiling.
In her face, right?
You know, yeah.
That was pretty awesome. That's an awesome scene. But this is close.
Yeah, this is close.
Yeah, and I have to give credit where credit is due. Jack Albertson put on like the best performance he ever, ever did. I mean, it was fabulous. He was so creepy in this film.
Yes, he was.
Now, there are other films that kind of touch similar sort of things. There's Mausoleum, and of course there's Phantasm, and there's other movies that involve sort of like mortuaries and you know, that sort of thing. None of them really come close, and they were all kind of early 80s kinds of films. None of them are really as good in this, in my opinion, as Dead and Buried. So from a purely crafting point of view and from a purely frightened point of view, I think this movie's is much better. Even though they did add extra gore and extra violence, I think they managed to do a really good job with it. So, anyway, I think we've pretty much talked this film as much as we could. Wanted to see if there were any other little bits and pieces of information, but I think we pretty much covered it all. I kind of wish, like I said, that there's a Blu-ray version of this floating out there someplace. Maybe there is somewhere. But if there is, I'm definitely going to buy it and add it to my collection. I think there are some parts where the film could be cleaned up a little bit. I don't know if Blue Underground did much cleanup on their DVD, but a 4K restoration or a Blu-ray transfer would make this movie look even better, in my opinion. And love to hear more information, too. But anyway, I want to thank everybody for joining us once again here on Forgotten Horror Classics. And we will come back to you next month with a brand new film that we think needs to be restored or brought back to the attention of people who have either forgotten about it or overlooked it or never saw it in the first place, and just reintroduce it to a whole new group of people. So thank you all very much for joining us. Laura, do you have any final words?
Not that I can think of.
No. Okay. Oh, there was that one tiny little continuity error.
Oh, right, the typewriter.
I guess we could mention that. That was in the sheriff's office where she's typing up something for him to send out on the telex, and we noticed that there's no paper in the actual typewriter. She's just kind of banging the keys with her fingers. Little continuity error there. But other than that, really, really good film. And no problems, no issues. Definitely check it out.
Yeah.
Okay. So we will see you next time on Forgotten Horror Classics.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.